Chapter 137. Hollow, said my uncle, falling back a step or two. That's familiar. It's so on the way, Bill, said the guard. Isn't there a mister before it? Said my uncle. For he felt, gentlemen, that for a guard he didn't know, to call him Jack Martin was a liberty which the post office wouldn't have sanctioned if they had known it. No, there is not, rejoined the guard coolly. Is the fare paid? Inquired my uncle. Of course it is, rejoined the guard. It is it? Said my uncle. Then here goes. Which coach? This, said the guard, pointing to an old-fashioned Edinburgh and London mail, which had the steps down and the door open. Stop. Here are the other passengers. Let them get in first. As the guard spoke, there all at once appeared, right in front of my uncle, a young gentleman in a powdered wig, and a sky-blue coat trimmed with silver, made very full, and broad in the skirts, which were lined with buckram. Tiggin and Welps were in the printed calico and waistcoat piece line, gentlemen, so my uncle knew all the materials at once. He wore knee breeches, and a kind of leggings rolled up over his silk stockings, and shoes with buckles. He had ruffles at his wrists, a three-cornered hat on his head, and a long taper sword by his side. The flaps of his waistcoat came halfway down his thighs, and the ends of his cravat reached to his waist. He stalked gravely to the coach door, pulled off his hat, and held it above his head at arm's length, cocking his little finger in the air at the same time, as some affected people do when they take a cup of tea. Then he drew his feet together, and made a low, grave bow, and then put out his left hand. My uncle was just going to step forward, and shake it heartily, when he perceived that these attentions were directed, not towards him, but to a young lady who just then appeared at the foot of the steps, attired in an old-fashioned green velvet dress with a long waist and stomacher. She had no bonnet on her head, gentlemen, which was muffled in a black silk hood, but she looked round for an instant as she prepared to get into the coach, and such a beautiful face as she disclosed, my uncle had never seen, not even in a picture. She got into the coach, holding up her dress with one hand, and as my uncle always said with a round oath, when he told the story, he wouldn't have believed it possible that legs and feet could have been brought to such a state of perfection, unless he had seen them with his own eyes. But, in this one glimpse of the beautiful face, my uncle saw that the young lady cast an imploring look upon him, and that she appeared terrified and distressed. He noticed, too, that the young fellow in the powdered wig, notwithstanding his show of gallantry, which was all very fine and grand, clasped her tight by the wrist when she got in, and followed himself immediately afterwards. An uncommonly ill-looking fellow, in a close brown wig, and a plum-colored suit, wearing a very large sword, and boots up to his hips, belonged to the party, and when he sat himself down next to the young lady, who shrank into a corner at his approach, my uncle was confirmed in his original impression that something dark and mysterious was going forward, or, as he always said himself, that there was a screw loose somewhere. It's quite surprising how quickly he made up his mind to help the lady at any peril, if she needed any help. Death and lightning! Exclaimed the young gentleman, laying his hand upon his sword as my uncle entered the coach. Blood and thunder! Roared the other gentleman. With this, he whipped his sword out, and made a lunge at my uncle without further ceremony. My uncle had no weapon about him, but with great dexterity he snatched the ill-looking gentleman's three-cornered hat from his head, and, receiving the point of his sword right through the crown, squeezed the sides together, and held it tight. Pink him behind! Cried the ill-looking gentleman to his companion, as he struggled to regain his sword. He had better not, cried my uncle, displaying the heel of one of his shoes, in a threatening manner. I'll kick his brains out, if he has any, or fracture his skull if he hasn't. Exerting all his strength, At this moment, my uncle wrenched the ill-looking man's sword from his grasp, and flung it clean out of the coach window, upon which the younger gentleman vociferated, "Death and lightning!" again, and laid his hand upon the hilt of his sword, in a very fierce manner, but didn't draw it. Perhaps, gentlemen, as my uncle used to say with a smile, perhaps he was afraid of alarming the lady. "Now, gentlemen," said my uncle, taking his seat deliberately, "I don't want to have any death, with or without lightning, in a lady's presence, and we have had quite blood and thundering enough for one journey. So, if you please, we'll sit in our places like quiet insides. Here, guard, pick up that gentleman's carving knife." As quickly as my uncle said the words, the guard appeared at the coach window, with the gentleman's sword in his hand. He held up his lantern, and looked earnestly in my uncle's face, as he handed it in, when, by its light, my uncle saw, to his great surprise, that an immense crowd of male coach guards swarmed round the window, every one of whom had his eyes earnestly fixed upon him too. He had never seen such a sea of white faces, red bodies, and earnest eyes, in all his born days. "This is the strangest sort of thing I ever had anything to do with," thought my uncle. "Allow me to return you your hat, sir." The ill-looking gentleman received his three-cornered hat in silence, looked at the hole in the middle with an inquiring air, and finally stuck it on the top of his wig with a solemnity the effect of which was a trifle impaired by his sneezing violently at the moment, and jerking it off again. "All right," cried the guard with the lantern, mounting into his little seat behind. Away they went. My uncle peeped out of the coach window as they emerged from the yard, and observed that the other males, with coachmen, guards, horses, and passengers, complete, were driving round and round in circles, at a slow trot of about 5 miles an hour. My uncle burned with indignation, "Gentlemen, as a commercial man, he felt that the mailbags were not to be trifled with, and he resolved to memorialize the post office on the subject, the very instant he reached London. At present, however, his thoughts were occupied with the young lady who sat in the farthest corner of the coach, with her face muffled closely in her hood, the gentleman with the sky blue coat sitting opposite to her, the other man in the plum-colored suit, by her side, and both watching her intently. If she so much as rustled the folds of her hood, he could hear the ill-looking man clap his hand upon his sword, and could tell by the other's breathing it was so dark he couldn't see his face, that he was looking as big as if he were going to devour her at a mouthful. This roused my uncle more and more, and he resolved, come what might, to see the end of it. He had a great admiration for bright eyes, and sweet faces, and pretty legs and feet. In short, he was fond of the whole sex. It runs in our family, gentlemen, so am one. Many were the devices which my uncle practiced, to attract the lady's attention, or at all events, to engage the mysterious gentleman in conversation. They were all in vain. The gentleman wouldn't talk, and the lady didn't dare. He thrust his head out of the coach window at intervals, and bawled out to know why they didn't go faster. But he called till he was hoarse. Nobody paid the least attention to him. He leaned back in the coach, and thought of the beautiful face, and the feet and legs. This answered better. It whiled away the time, and kept him from wondering where he was going, and how it was that he found himself in such an odd situation. Not that this would have worried him much, anyway he was a mighty free and easy, roving, devil-may-care sort of person, was my uncle, gentlemen. All of a sudden the coach stopped. "Hallo," said my uncle, "what's in the wind now?" "A light here," said the guard, letting down the steps. "Here," cried my uncle. "Here," rejoined the guard. "I'll do nothing of the sort," said my uncle. "Very well, then stop where you are," said the guard. "I will," said my uncle. "Do," said the guard. The passengers had regarded this colloquy with great attention, and, finding that my uncle was determined not to alight, the younger man squeezed past him, to hand the lady out. At this moment, the ill-looking man was inspecting the hole in the crown of his three-cornered hat. As the young lady brushed past, she dropped one of her gloves into my uncle's hand, and softly whispered, with her lips so close to his face that he felt her warm breath on his nose, the single word, "Help!" Gentlemen, my uncle leaped out of the coach at once, with such violence that it rocked on the springs again. "Oh, you've thought better of it, have you?" said the guard, when he saw my uncle standing on the ground. My uncle looked at the guard for a few seconds, in some doubt whether it wouldn't be better to wrench his blunderbuss from him, fire it in the face of the man with the big sword, knock the rest of the company over the head with the stock, snatch up the young lady, and go off in the smoke. On second thoughts, however, he abandoned this plan, as being a shade too melodramatic in the execution, and followed the two mysterious men, who, keeping the lady between them, were now entering an old house in front, of which the coach had stopped. They turned into the passage, and my uncle followed. Of all the ruinous and desolate places my uncle had ever beheld, this was the most so. It looked as if it had once been a large house of entertainment, but the roof had fallen in many places, and the stairs were steep, rugged, and broken. There was a huge fireplace in the room into which they walked, and the chimney was blackened with smoke, but no warm blaze lighted it up now. The white feathery dust of burned wood was still strewed over the hearth, but the stove was cold, and all was dark and gloomy. "Well," said my uncle, as he looked about him, "a mail traveling at the rate of 6 miles and a half an hour, and stopping for an indefinite time at such a hole as this, is rather an irregular sort of proceeding, I fancy. This shall be made known. I'll write to the papers." My uncle said this in a pretty loud voice, and in an open, unreserved sort of manner, with the view of engaging the two strangers in conversation if he could. But neither of them took any more notice of him than whispering to each other, and scowling at him as they did so. The lady was at the farther end of the room, and once she ventured to wave her hand, as if beseeching my uncle's assistance. At length the two strangers advanced a little, and the conversation began in earnest. "You don't know this is a private room, I suppose, fellow?" said the gentleman in sky blue. "No, I do not, fellow," rejoined my uncle. "Only, if this is a private room specially ordered for the occasion, I should think the public room must be a very comfortable one." With this, my uncle sat himself down in a high back chair, and took such an accurate measure of the gentleman, with his eyes, that Tiggin and Welps could have supplied him with printed calico for a suit, and not an inch too much or too little, from that estimate alone. "Quit this room," said both men together, grasping their swords. "Eh?" said my uncle, not at all appearing to comprehend their meaning. "Quit the room, or you are a dead man," said the ill-looking fellow with the large sword, drawing it at the same time and flourishing it in the air. "Down with him," cried the gentleman in sky blue, drawing his sword also, and falling back 2 or 3 yards. "Down with him." The lady gave a loud scream. Now, my uncle was always remarkable for great boldness, and great presence of mind. All the time that he had appeared so indifferent to what was going on, he had been looking slyly about for some missile or weapon of defense, and at the very instant when the swords were drawn, he espied, standing in the chimney corner, an old basket-hilted rapier in a rusty scabbard. At one bound, my uncle caught it in his hand, drew it, flourished it gallantly above his head, called aloud to the lady to keep out of the way, hurled the chair at the man in sky blue, and the scabbard at the man in plum color, and taking advantage of the confusion, fell upon them both, pell-mell. Gentlemen, there is an old story none the worse for being true regarding a fine young Irish gentleman, who, being asked if he could play the fiddle, replied he had no doubt he could, but he couldn't exactly say for certain, because he had never tried. This is not inapplicable to my uncle and his fencing. He had never had a sword in his hand before, except once when he played Richard III at a private theater, upon which occasion it was arranged with Richmond that he was to be run through, from behind, without showing fight at all. But here he was, cutting and slashing with two experienced swordsmen, thrusting, and guarding, and poking, and slicing, and acquitting himself in the most manful and dexterous manner possible, although up to that time he had never been aware that he had the least notion of the science. It only shows how true the old saying is, that a man never knows what he can do till he tries, gentlemen. The noise of the combat was terrific, each of the three combatants swearing like troopers, and their swords clashing with as much noise as if all the knives and steels in Newport Market were rattling together at the same time. When it was at its very height, the lady, to encourage my uncle most probably, withdrew her hood entirely from her face, and disclosed a countenance of such dazzling beauty that he would have fought against 50 men to win one smile from it and die. He had done wonders before, but now he began to powder away like a raving mad giant. At this very moment, the gentleman in sky blue turning round, and seeing the young lady with her face uncovered, vented an exclamation of rage and jealousy, and, turning his weapon against her beautiful bosom, pointed a thrust at her heart, which caused my uncle to utter a cry of apprehension that made the building ring. The lady stepped lightly aside, and snatching the young man's sword from his hand, before he had recovered his balance, drove him to the wall, and running it through him, and the paneling, up to the very hilt, pinned him there, hard and fast. It was a splendid example. My uncle, with a loud shout of triumph, and a strength that was irresistible, made his adversary retreat in the same direction, and plunging the old rapier into the very center of a large red flower in the pattern of his waistcoat, nailed him beside his friend. There they both stood, gentlemen, jerking their arms and legs about in agony, like the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.